Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. Mark Dvorak and I have about 800 friends in common. Some of them are still alive, and I've known Mark and his music for many years, and decided to have him on in part because I admire his music, but also in part because he has a new book. He's a folk musician who also writes books, which, you know, it's not that unusual.
No.
Mark, in your book, you write this. You write, "I remember coming of age and the coming of music into my life. The songs I really liked while growing up, I mostly liked in private. They were corny." You've spent your whole life in music.
Yeah.
How did you're a Southwest Sider?
Yes, Cicero.
And tell me about your family.
Cicero's, when I was a little kid, the older boys didn't play cops and robbers. They played Al Capone and Elliot Ness.
Yeah, right.
And Al Capone was the good guy. So, in a working class town, and my grandfather and grandmother lived across the street, and we lived with my other grandfather on my mom's side, and I have three brothers. And we lived in a little Georgian, the six of us in one bedroom, and Grandpa in the other bedroom, and it was a good family life. And
what'd your dad do?
He worked for a chemical company in the office. He didn't like that, but he spent time in the National Guard, and I think he had an inclination to become a career soldier, but he didn't want to travel.
Yeah,
so he got a job with and when he got a job, white collar. He got to wear a white collar, and he was with that company for I don't know how many years, but until he retired.
And how many kids was it? Three boys?
Mom had four boys.
Okay.
And I'm number three.
And she must have been a full-time mom.
She was a full-time mom, uh-huh. But in that neighborhood, it's kind of like all the parents took care of all the kids, you know?
And, exactly, sure.
And
sure.
So it was, looking back on it, you know, I go, it was a pretty good way to live up, a pretty good way to grow up, I thought. And
when did music, I mean, apocryphally, and I've talked to a number of people about you, music didn't come into your life when someone gave you a biography of Bob Dylan. Is that true, or is made up by a writer?
That's when I read the Anthony Scaduto's biography of Bob Dylan. I think it came out in 72 or something. I think I got it a couple of years later. He talked about Pete Seeger.
Seeger, sure.
And then Seeger talked about Leadbelly and Woody Guthrie. And all.
And did you, before that, heard of any of these people?
Names, uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, and I had my one just older than me brother. He was is a very, very gifted guy. He picked up the guitar from scratch and figured out how to play it.
Mm.
And he's also had experience, self-taught, of a visual artist. And he, for 30 years, he repaired instruments. And my younger brother had the guitar, too. I was the last one to get a guitar. And I worked, wound up, my first job was, one of my first jobs, I was working in a xylophone factory in LaGrange, Illinois.
Wow.
It's a company called Musser. And
are they still in business?
No. They got bought up. And but one of my best friends I met on that job. I'm going to go see him this weekend in St. Louis. We're going to play a concert together. But through that union, I was able to buy a guitar for like $40.
Wow.
And he played a little bit.
What was it that drew you three boys to music like that?
My parents couldn't figure it out.
Can't figure it out.
And my oldest brother, he didn't play, but he's very creative in other ways. And before my parents passed away, I talked to them about it, and I said, you let us do things, you know?
Yeah.
And we didn't, I think I was the only one of my brothers. I went to community college for about a year. And but the rest of us went straight to work.
Where'd you guys go to high school?
We moved to the suburbs, to LaGrange area, Lyons Township.
Mm-hmm.
My mom did everything she could to get us to graduate, you know.
What year were you born?
I was born in 56. So,
okay. Yeah. You were the youngest of the three? Or?
Three. I'm three out of four.
Okay. Yeah. What did that fourth one do? Did he get music too?
Yeah, he was a headbanger, and he had bands and just loud and raucous and.
That's so interesting. Yeah, music wasn't part of your parents' life
no.
as you remember in the house.
No, they played a lot of records
yeah.
in the house. We had all kinds of records and. My dad loved Johnny Cash, and you know, and
not a bad person.
Not
love.
A bad, yeah. And my brother Steve, who's a year older than me, he was heavy into the blues, and he started a band. He was still in high school, and they were like they're teenagers, and they were like Kingston Mines was the place, and this
sure.
guy hired them to play there, and. And so my mom did everything she could to get him through school. And
it sounds like all four of you guys had trouble getting through school.
Well, we were interested in things,
yeah.
you know, I don't think any of us are good at taking direction. You know, I think that's the problem.
Well, but one of the hallmarks of. Mark Dvorak's life is his career as a teacher. He is not just a performer and a writer. He's a teacher. And when you read this book, 31 Winters, Finding the Folkway, you will realize how passionate he is about teaching. He's going to be here this entire hour, and we'll be back in a couple minutes. Mark Dvorak is in here sitting and talking about getting a guitar when he was young, and his brothers had guitar. And we were just talking about, you know, when we were young, it was easy to discover things instead of having sort of your life pre-programmed. When did you start to take it? You said your brother taught himself to play and taught himself to repair instruments. Who taught you to play?
Well, I had two brothers. There were guitars laying around, and my friend Tim Lilly, who now lives in St. Louis, he could play already, and so I learned a lot from him, and then finally one day, Tim and I went on a long motorcycle trip one summer. We spent the entire summer driving around the country, and when I got home, I decided to enroll in classes at the Old Town School of Folk Music.
What did you know of the Old Town School?
I had only known of it,
yeah.
And so I looked into it, and in those days, they'd put a coupon in the newspaper, you could cut it out and send in your $25.
Was it an Armitage?
That was at the Armitage building,
yeah.
Right. And my teacher was a guy named Mike Dunbar, who was, and we're still in touch to this day. And he was a remarkable teacher, and he could work with all kinds of different people at the same time. And
did you want to take lessons? Obviously, you want to take lessons first of all, to learn how to play.
Right.
Were you thinking about this as a possible career? You said one of your brothers was playing places like the Kingston Mines.
Yeah. No, I never anticipated making my living in music, but I wanted to be close to it, and I love the sound of the guitar, and then later the five-string banjo. And when I walked into the Old Town School my first night of class, the place was still being run by hippies then, you know, and I thought, oh, this is it.
I thought,
if I can get good enough, maybe one day I'll come back here and teach music at the Old Town School. And all along, I mean, there was pictures of Win Strachey and the famous Peggy Lipschutz paintings of
sure.
Big Bill, Pete, and Woody Guthrie, and there's Big Bill's guitar right in the case, and
the plays, I remember the Armitage, I mean, mm-hmm. it was kind of in a wonderful way inspiring just by being there.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing when you're of a certain age, you are open to influence, and so that was 79, and then in the autumn of 86, Michael Miles phoned me to come down for an interview, and I had been practicing teaching. I was teaching out of my apartment.
How were you making a living?
I worked for making a living is generous, but my main job was I worked for a grocery company, Jewel Foods, and I signed up for the night shift, and they started you out as part time. But when I started, there was a lot of hours available, and I took them. And you get health insurance. I think I paid $5.50 a month for health insurance.
Wow.
You know, and
what were you doing for Jewel?
Unloading trucks and stocking shelves and cleaning. You know, grunt work.
Yeah, sure.
And then in the daytimes, you know, I'd sleep a little bit and get my guitar out and go to work at it, and I'd teach classes.
Where were you living?
In Brookfield, Illinois, then.
I
had a little house with a buddy of mine in Lyons, and then got an apartment in this beautiful old attic apartment in this old house in Brookfield, and so that's where I started to dig in. And always, you know, I knew that where my friends were flying down to Nashville to pitch their songs and stuff, I knew I wasn't in that.
You weren't writing songs then. You were just learning to play the guitar.
I was playing with it, but I was learning songs. And you know who was a big influence was, you remember Fred Holstein, of course.
And, oh, absolutely.
I studied him, and also Art Thieme. And I thought, these guys must know thousands of songs.
And you also knew, you must have known at the time that John Prine famously went to, John became a star pretty quickly
with his first album. He got picked right off the stage. But what I decided to do with my friends is we started this little organization in the church basement called the Old Quarter Coffee House. We named it after a Townes Van Zandt album.
Oh.
And some guy in the neighborhood liked the idea, so he and his wife bought a storefront. So we had this little venue.
Where was it?
Brookfield.
Wow.
And then I was teaching classes out of that, and that ran for about 6 years. And so I was always working in terms of, let's get this group of people together.
I mean, you really found a comfortable place in the world of folk musicians in the Old Town School, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
It sounds that way to me.
Yeah. Well, I always had the idea of creating this space. I wasn't that interested in the music business. I knew that wasn't my thing. And by the time I started recording, LPs were on their way out, and you know, airplay was pretty rough to get for a guy like me. So I always concentrated on developing these community projects
and live performance.
Live performance, right?
Yeah.
That's where I make my living.
Well, Michael Miles was a teacher at the Old Town School for ages, and one of the world's great banjo players.
Yes, he is,
and one of the world's great guys.
He's a great guy.
Yeah, he's a great guy. When did you start, this is fascinating, you got this little club, when did you start and feel capable enough to become a teacher? How does that translate? When do you say, look, you obviously, from everything I've heard and read in your fine book, you love teaching and took to teaching.
I did take to it. And people started asking, you know, and like I said, I was teaching in the Park District in Brookfield out of my apartment.
Gotcha.
I was practicing to maybe ask for a job at the Old Town School. And
was it a little intimidating to do that?
Yeah.
At the time, the Old Town School was not the Old Town School it is today.
No, and they were just, that was in the years when Jim Hirsch had taken over, and they were just rebuilding it.
Right.
I think I was the 25th teacher hired.
Wow.
But you know, and I felt like when I started teaching out of my apartment, I said, look, these are for free. Just, if you want to leave something, leave it.
Wow.
Because I didn't want the pressure.
That's right. But that's also in the great, great, great folk music tradition. That really is.
Well, there's a book I read that was, I read this book the same year I met Frank Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is by a guy named W.H. Matthew called The Listening Book.
Yep.
And he's a great teacher. And by then I was imagining that teaching was going to be something I would be doing. And so I learned from him. And he said, like, one of his problems was when he played a concert of multi-ethnic influenced piano improvisations, people said, very interesting. He goes, when I taught a class, he goes, they said, thank you.
Wow.
And he said, I realized in my classes I was helping people.
And that motivated you. We got to take a little break, and you're going to hear some news, and then we will continue on. I'm going to ask Mark DeVart to go in there and give Dan Long a song for you to hear, because we've just talked about him teaching and doing other stuff, and I want you to hear him, too, so we'll be back. Welcome back. One of the highlights of my guests, Mark Dvorak's latest book, which is titled 31, the number, 31 Winters, Finding the Folk Way. And I called when Mark first came in the studio, and you weren't listening because we weren't on the air. I said, this book is kind of like a memoir and a philosophical treatise. And he goes, yeah, maybe I'll use that. I go, no, don't call it. It's kind of a memoir, but it's also an incredibly lively book. And by memoir, I mean, dude, it's filled with your memories. Your memory in here about meeting and getting to know Win Strachey, the co-founder, just he's basically now known as the co-founder of the Old Town School, but he was so much more.
Yes.
I mean, he's an important figure in your life. You met him late.
I met him late, and the impact was immediate and enduring.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a visionary.
Yeah, and you do a wonderful thing of talking about how you can, walking around the Old Town School, even now, the Old Town School on Lincoln Avenue in Lincoln Square, is you are like walking inside Wynn's dream. I find that lovely.
That's the way I always thought of it. In fact, when they were building that building on Lincoln Avenue, so that's more than 20 years ago now, and Jim Hirsch was the executive director, and he did a neat thing, is every Thursday afternoon at 4 o'clock, he took whoever want on a tour of this building being renovated, and the theater was being built, and you could see where the wiring was going, and there's going to be an elevator here. And that's when it dawned on me. We're inside Win Strachey's dream right here.
Yeah, I love that.
It's true.
This book, before we're going to listen to you play, but this book is grown out of the strange time called the pandemic that we lived in.
It did.
I mean, you didn't want to just sit at home and watch reruns of game shows or something.
No.
That was basically the seed of this. Some of the pieces in here are things you've written before.
Yeah, they're from other newsletters.
And some speeches you gave.
I gave some presentations.
And what did you want to do? When you started gathering this, you write a little about it in the beginning. What were you trying to do here, Mark?
A couple of different things. Is one, as I look back on the times where these stories came from, it reminded me of a kaleidoscope. You know, my memories from here and these people, but yet they're all these experiences and different people, but they're all somehow connected. And then it dawned on me, there are some pieces in there that are actually almost like a guitar lesson. And I wanted that in there because I'm imagining some guy riding the train to work, and he says, here's how you make a D chord. And he's going to say, I bet I could do that.
Yeah.
You know? And so, but at the same time, I wanted this to read as if it was one of my classes. When I had a good class, it was filled with stories, filled with instruction, something from way out here that didn't seem related, but at the end, it is.
But I also think part of teaching, I've always felt, is a sharing of oneself.
I think so. Yeah.
I can't
do it any other way.
Yeah.
This
book too. I don't know if you're teaching someone about life here, but you may. There's such chapters as Six Things I Find Really Cool About Folk Music is a great chapter, and then here, some notes on teaching. There are 55 notes on teaching, ladies and gentlemen. You gave Dan Long a song. It's part of, it was a group you were in with some wonderful people, among them the late Michael Smith. Talk to me about Michael. I knew Michael. I was a great admirer of Michael's.
Yeah, I'm very proud to have known him and feel lucky to have worked with he and Barbara for, you know, more than 10 years.
Yeah.
And he called me up one day, and he said, Mark, I hear you have a long-neck banjo. And I go, I do. He goes, Barbara and I are working on a new project. We want to do all the Weavers songs. Can you sing Pete Seeger's part? And I think I said, I doubt it. But we went
not on your life.
I went on over to their apartment, and we sat around one afternoon and played. And I always kid around. I go, I think I got the job simply because I had the right instrument, the long neck banjo. But I sure grew a lot during that whole experience.
I found Michael was just one of the kindest. I'm sure he had a dark side somewhere. I never saw it. But one of the kindest, gentlest people.
An
incredible songwriter.
Incredible songwriter. In fact, there's a little story in the chapter about Michael and Barbara where he set the bar high for rehearsal.
I'm sure.
And I learned from that. And so we usually get our coffee around 10 or 11 in the morning, and we'd go over the stuff we'd been working on. And he's singing the bass part, and he's got this little cap on,
sure.
And he's writing notes in the margins in the newspaper. And Tom Dundee and I, we go, uh-oh. He's more stuff to fix, you know. And then next song he writes down again. Next song he writes down again. Then the phone rings. He goes in the other room to get the phone call. And Tom and I look over at the paper. He was writing lyrics to a new song.
Wow.
While singing the bass part.
Wow.
So he had an extra gear, you know, maybe two.
An amazing guy. What song did you give Dan?
Oh, this was the first song we worked on in Weaver Mania. This is called Whim Away.
Yep.
That's pretty good. Look at you smiling.
Oh,
those guys, that has to bring back great memories.
Great memories. And we played that record for Pete Seeger one time in out east, and he listened to it, and he shook his head. He goes, who's ever singing that high part, that guy's going to lose his voice.
You must miss Michael.
I do, and I think about him often. And he reserved a lot of space for himself.
Sure.
And I think that's why we got along. I always respected that, And when the word came that he was not doing so well, I wrote him a note on Facebook. And then he posted a very funny last remark to everybody. He said, please don't send me any Facebook messages. He said, if they manage to fix me up, I'll never be able to click all those likes. That's very, very, sarcastic and literary, but I wrote him a last note anyway,
good.
Yeah, in fact, the autumn, he died in 2020, I believe, and the autumn before, we got to play together in Fitzgerald's, an event for a little organization I'm now involved with called Music and Potlucks, and every autumn we do a series of events, and Michael came out. And Heather Steika was there, and we did Songwriters in the Round, and that was the last time I heard him play.
Wow.
And so,
If you don't know Michael Smith, look up Michael Smith. But also, Mark Dvorak has a great, I think, has a great website. He said he used to do some things on it that made people love it, but I love it the way it is now. It's just Mark, MarkDvorak.com.
That's it.
You can buy, you have 20, your most recent CD. I still call these albums.
They are albums.
Yeah, exactly.
Know?
The most recent one is called
Live and Alone.
Live and Alone. It's got a very cool picture of Mark on the front, but this is his 21st.
20 or 21, I don't remember. And
well, you lose count after 20.
Yeah.
But go there, and you can get that CD and everything. We got to take a short little break then come back and talk to Mark some more, so stay tuned. Welcome back. I have a few more minutes with Mark Dvorak, who's been good enough to come in here and spend the entire hour on the show. You heard him as part of Weaver Mania. You can hear his other 20 or 21 albums. We've lost track. The latest, Living Alone. He's a grand talent. One of the things we talked about a little off air is he loves to teach, and he also loves to perform live because we are living in an age, I think, that is sort of fighting to make us all remote. To listen remotely, to listen on our phones and do that. That's what I think one of the essences of folk music is the human intercourse that is involved in it. Don't you think, Mark?
Absolutely. In one of the pieces I gave a talk for the Community College Humanities Association, and I go, what's it mean when you got 1,000 Facebook friends and don't know the names of your 5 neighbors? And what's it mean when little boys and girls can't sing B-I-N-G-O or She'll Be Coming Around the Mountain? And we're losing the ability to be human beings again.
Yeah, I know.
And to interact like human beings. And all you can do, in our political, current political climate, you go, I don't have any power to make an impact on any of that, but through art, through songs and writing, talking with friends, this is the power we have immediately, and to embrace each other in those terms, I think is... It will go a long way.
Well, because I think it's an innate human power. You can imagine millennia ago of a caveman grunting to another caveman. I'm serious about
that's right.
Or like scratching a something
right.
on a wall.
Right.
The impact of that is not to be denied. And, to listen to, a million talking heads on TV is not the same.
Before I came up, I spent a little time on the Riverwalk down there, and I hadn't been down there in a long time, and in pandemic, none of us went anywhere, but it was just jam-packed with people eating ice cream, walking, taking a boat ride. I mean, stuff like that is encouraging, and when I keep myself at home too much, I keep forgetting that there's a world out there to participate in, and I don't always have to listen to the news all the time to get my idea of what's going on.
And you can see it because that's the Riverwalk and other places. That's humanity, man.
That's all it is.
That's humanity.
Yeah,
that's what
beautiful.
It's all about. And you must get it in a different kind of way than I ever do by performing live.
Yeah.
I have heard from. And I so respect you and admire you as a performer. And most of the people I respect and admire performers are people who get something from. They don't feel like they're just giving.
Right.
It's a transactional thing.
It is. And that transaction is at the heart of what the folk arts are. It's not a track. It's an experience, I think. And I work very hard at trying to nourish my energies so that when it's time to sing and play and tell stories with people, I want it to come from somewhere, and I want it to land, and I want it to be authentic, and I want it to be a representative of something of our common experience as human beings here in Chicago and the Chicago area and the Midwest. And so it's kind of a small little idea I have about what I'm doing compared to, the phenomenon of Taylor Swift, God bless her. But, it's a huge thing, and I've never had any designs on being mass marketed. I mean, to me, this is this kind of performing is a retail business. You know,
you said you're performing in St. Louis with a friend. Mm-hmm. When is that?
It's Saturday night at the Center for Spiritual Living of St. Louis, and my friend Tim is going to play his pedal harp, and he's bringing his guitar, and we're going to do a couple songs from the old days that we used to do, and he's a wonderful friend.
Well, you've had a lot of wonderful friends. You've also had a lot of people in this book who you really, again, the book is 31 Winters Finding the Folk Way, which I find not just a memoir, but it's a book that if you never get to meet Mark Dvorak in person, you will get to know him a bit. I'm serious.
Beautiful.
From this book. It's a very honest book. It's a very thoughtful book. You'll read about Win Strachey among many, many people. And if you want to become a teacher of any kind, you can get 55, count them, 55 notes on teaching. I'll tell you a couple before I let Mark go. I heard once that there is a time to teach music and a time to teach people. After 25 years at the Old Town School of Folk Music, my best guess is that you should start with people. Another one. Your students are human beings, just like you. They are busy and have feelings, just like you. If you aren't the most talented or knowledgeable person in the classroom, be the funniest. That is something any teacher would just so appreciate. If you're not the most talented musician, just be funny. Be funny. Or then you can be like Ed Holstein, who's very funny and a very good musician.
He's a very good musician.
Yeah, he really is. And a good teacher. He takes great joy in teaching.
Yes, he does.
Too. Great joy in
He's
teaching.
He's got a lot to offer.
Yeah. Well, so do you. Mark Dvorak, it is a great pleasure to finally meet you. I know we bumped into each other.
We've been bumping.
When you're as old as we are, you do bump into one another.
Yes, sir.